Hi, Simon. Welcome back to AIXFM.
Good to be back again.
Yeah, because today we'll talk not about your computers, rather than what I'm interested in is added value of Zulu, of DJD. Oh, not only Zulu, of Azul in the context of Java, and maybe even beyond.
Right.
And I had a chat recently with a gentleman called Ian Rogers. You know this guy?
Name doesn't ring a bell, no.
Ian Rogers? He worked for Azul a longer time ago, and he is actually the inventor of C4.
Oh, okay.
And what's interesting that the C4 is based on XOR. On XOR is one of the killer use cases, and Ian found it out on the way to Java 1 like 15 years ago because he forgot his laptop. So he did. He was forced to use a pencil and a paper, and this is how I got the idea. Not forgot his laptop; it was an intentional decision because the laptop was too big, and he was afraid to be robbed basically in SFO. Mm-hmm. So this is my background story regarding C4. So maybe you will continue with C4 because
Yes. Yeah. So, if we look at what Azul has done, as you say, there's Zulu, which is the idea of just a straight build of OpenJDK. And we can come back to what the benefits of that are. But if we focus initially on what used to be called Zing, is really still called Zing, which is the JVM. And then we have a thing called Prime, Azul Prime, which is the product that we sell using Zing. The idea behind Zing is to look at Java and say, how could we improve the performance of Java without changing application code? And that's the important thing, because you don't want to have to change your code. You don't want to have to recompile anything. It's just about improving the way that the JVM works. And so the initial work on that, as you quite rightly point out, was around garbage collection, because that was really, if we go back 15 years, that was the thing that caused people, I would say, the most problems. Mm-hmm. The latency that was associated with garbage collection, because at that time, all the algorithms that were being used, certainly in Hotspot, were stop the world algorithms, meaning that if we wanted to do the work of the garbage collector, we had to pause the application threads in order to move objects around the heap safely so that we didn't end up changing an object in one place and then missing it as we copied it to another place. So we pause the application threads. And that leads to pauses which can be significant. If you're lucky, you see sort of tens of milliseconds, maybe a couple of hundreds of milliseconds, and that's not really noticeable. Mm-hmm. Get into bigger pauses and you can see like seconds, which is when things do start to interrupt in terms of you've got an application which does need to have fairly real-time response, then that's going to cause a problem. The biggest garbage collection pause I've ever heard of was 1.5 days. Mm-hmm. And that was a company that was using an enormous heap, like terabytes of heap. And they literally had this 1.5 day pause for garbage collection.
Vacations.
And when I was talking to them, I said, well, hang on. Firstly, how do you even know that it's still doing garbage collection? I mean, after a couple of hours, don't you just assume that the JVM has frozen and got locked in a loop? I said, no. We have instrumentation. We're using JMX, and we can actually see that the garbage collection is still carrying on. And then I said, well, okay. But then the alternative surely is if you hit a 1.5 day pause, isn't it just easier to stop the application completely and restart it? And then you can get going again. And they said, oh, no. It actually takes longer than 1.5 days to load all the data into the heap.
So when was it? Was it recently?
No. This was early in my career at Azul. So this probably would have been like nearly 10 years ago.
Okay.
And it was a very extreme situation in terms of what the application was doing and so on. But coming back to C4. So the problem is you get these pauses that affect applications. So what we did with C4 was to look at the way the garbage collector works. And as you said, Ian and Gil, who's our CTO, came up with this approach called C4, which is the Continuous Concurrent Compacting Collector. That's what it stands for. And that essentially tells you what it does, because it is continuous. It runs in the background and does all the work that a garbage collector needs to do. It is concurrent. That is the most important aspect. It is fully concurrent, which means that there are no stop the world pauses associated with this garbage collector in order to do the work of the garbage collector. Now, it's not totally pauseless because you will see some impact in terms of reaching a global safe point. So some threads will pause briefly as they reach a global safe point. And then you will also see very, very small pauses as we copy objects around within the heap. So we put a lock around
Concurrent means pauseless only because the garbage collector runs in another thread.
Yes.
Along with the application. So yes. It's not the same thread. So if it collects the garbage, it doesn't have to stop the application. That's right. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So you've got fully concurrent garbage collection. It compacts as well. So there are algorithms which don't pause, but they don't compact. Mm-hmm. So you end up with a lot of fragmentation and it becomes difficult after a while to allocate space. So we do compact the heap. We eliminate fragmentation, but we can do that concurrently. And the way that works is through a lock, and it's a loaded value barrier. So it's essentially a read barrier, which means every access you have to an object in the heap, we will intercept that and we will run a test to see whether we need to do some work in relation to that object. Mm-hmm. So you might immediately say, well, okay, if you're intercepting every read of an object, doesn't that degrade performance because you're putting in extra work? But the reality is that because we use bits in the object header, we can do a very simple test and jump, which is two instructions, which once you compile that down into microcode, it's basically one micro instruction, so less than a nanosecond of overhead per read. Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, we need to do some work, but most of the time you don't have to do anything. So this allows us to do fully concurrent garbage collection. We can scale up to, at the moment, we scale up to a 20 terabyte heap without having to have any pauses associated with that.
And why not more? I mean, because if you say, you know, until 20 terabytes of heap, which is huge, but why not 21? So I'm just asking.
And here is the ridiculousness of this situation. Because we use bits in the object header to mm-hmm. represent the state of the object mm-hmm. in sense of mm-hmm. the garbage collection, we can't use the full 64 bits of the object header to address the object. Mm-hmm. So we're limited in how many bits we have. So if we wanted to go beyond 20 terabytes, mm-hmm. what we need to do is find one bit. So one bit in the object header will allow us to go beyond 20 terabytes in terms of addressing the heap space. So it's one of those kind of ridiculous things where you think one bit
you should start like a coding competition. Find the bit and with prize, you know. This would be actually a cool exercise.
It would be. I know that we have a number of engineers who've spent a lot of time looking at this. So it would be... maybe we should throw it at AI.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that allows us to scale up to very large heaps and then do that without having any pauses. And so the idea behind this is, like I say, that eliminates the problem of latency associated with garbage collection. And that mm-hmm. was our first goal. And that was very successful for a wide range of applications, but not everything. So things like high-frequency trading platforms, ad brokering, anything that needed somewhat close to real-time performance and any pauses were going to cause problems. That was somewhere that C4 and Zing became very popular, and so we were able to sell a lot of instances in that sense.
Mm-hmm. What are you selling and what do you get for free?
You don't get anything for free with Zing. Mm-hmm. So we sell Zing as a product. So mm-hmm. it is a high-performance JVM, and we sell that so that people can use it. Zulu, which is our straight build of OpenJDK, we have our community edition, which is free.
Yeah, and what garbage collector has the Zulu?
So Zulu has exactly the same ones as Hotspot. So you get your G1, your serial, your parallel. Mm-hmm. I think they've removed CMS now, so that's not there. We also have ZGC in there, but I don't think we've got Shenandoah.
Okay.
We might do.
So, if it's, so it's still a good JDK. Choice, performant JDK, but not as good as this what you mentioned right now.
Exactly.
So there's no C4, which is a clean separation. So C4 is the GC, which you get on top of Zulu, right? So Zulu plus C4 and a little bit of hardening, I guess, is Zing, right?
Kind of. Essentially, with Zing, we take all of the other garbage collectors away. We don't need those at all. So there is only C4 in Zing. Mm-hmm. But with Zulu, as I said, you've got ZGC or ZGC, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. And that's almost pauseless garbage collector, which is heavily based on the way C4 works, because there was a paper that was published by us, and the developers of ZGC looked at that, and they developed their garbage collector based very heavily on the work of what C4 does.
Mm-hmm. So ZGC is C4 inspired.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Okay. This JDK is still the same, but all the garbage collectors are removed and you only get the C4 and you call it Zing.
That's right. But Zing is a little bit more than that, because having solved the problem of garbage collection and created C4, which is truly pauseless, we then said, okay, what else can we do to improve the performance of the JVM? And the thing that we then looked at was JIT compilation. Mm-hmm. So JIT compilation is where you take your bytecodes from your classes and your jar files, and then as the application runs, what we're doing is compiling frequently used pieces of code to improve the performance of your application. And you get the warm-up time that's associated with a Java application. So you go from fully interpreted mode, gradually more and more code gets compiled, and then you get to a point where all the frequently used pieces of code have been compiled and optimized, and that's your steady state. Mm-hmm. Now, what we did was we looked at the way that works, and in Hotspot, you've got two different JIT compilers. You've got C1 and C2. C1 is a simplistic compiler which compiles code very quickly, and so that's the first phase, but it doesn't apply a lot of optimizations. It does basic optimization, but doesn't really do much beyond that. What we then do inside the JVM is we take that C1 compiled code, we let it run, but we also profile how individual methods are being used, and that gives us a picture of what the code is actually doing as it runs. You then take a heavily used method and you say, right, let's feed this into C2, recompile it, and use the profiling information that we got under the C1 compile code, and then optimize it much more heavily to get better performance. What we did with Zing was said, okay, well, C1, we can't really make any improvement there. C2 is where we could improve things. And we said, let's take out C2 and replace it with a different JIT compiler. And the JIT compiler that we created is called Falcon, but it's based essentially on LLVM as a mm-hmm. compiler project. And that's an open source project, been around for a long time. Lots of people contribute engineering resources to that. You've got people from Microsoft, NVIDIA, ARM, Apple, Intel, all the people who would understand how compilers work contribute mm-hmm. to this project. Mm-hmm. And so we took that. LLVM really is the back end of a compiler where you take intermediate representation and generate optimized code. We took that, integrated it into the JVM, so it worked with the garbage collector and all the various other bits of the JVM, and then we contributed those changes back to LLVM, so if anybody else wanted to put it into a virtual machine, then they could use that work. What that allows us to do is to...
Is it like a module in LLVM, or is it an integral part of the LLVM, your contribution?
I'd say it's a module, because okay. It's not an integral part, yeah. Because the integral part is the compiler itself. Okay. We just contributed stuff that would allow you to use it as a JIT compiler if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. But could you use it as well for Swift development, let's say?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. I mean, that's why people from Apple work on it. It is essentially, like I said, the back end of a compiler and lots of
people. No, LLM, I know what LLM is, what LLVM is, but what you mentioned is that you contribute something back. So what I'm interested in, what do you contributed back to LLVM?
Right. What essentially, the wrapper around it, which allows you to use it with a JVM.
Okay.
So that the integration okay. with the garbage collector is one of the biggest things that you have to
do. So it's less interesting for Swift developers and
more...
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. It was just that we felt that was good open source sort of community spirit kind of thing. Not keeping what we'd done secret, but contributing it back to the
project. It's also very smart, because if someone finds a bug or whatever, you can also benefit. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what that allows us to do is to generate more heavily optimized code than you get from C2. Now, C2 has been around since 1998, and it's very monolithic in its approach to design. So it's a big lump of code, and it's difficult to modify and enhance. LLVM, as you know, is very modular, so it's a lot easier to include new functionality and add new pieces of ways of doing optimizations and so on. So that allows us to take advantage of things that you can't do in C2, and we can then also use what are called speculative optimizations much more efficiently. Speculative optimizations are where you basically look at the way a piece of code has been run up until the point where you're compiling it, and you say, okay, we see it being used this particular way. Let's assume that it will continue to be used like that and optimize accordingly. Now, sometimes your assumptions prove to be wrong, and you then have to do what's called a de-optimization, and you essentially throw away the code that you've already compiled because it's wrong, and then you have to recompile it based on a new set of assumptions. So de-optimizations are bad. You want to avoid those.
I had a longer conversation about de-optimizing, because what I still don't get is why there's even a name for it. Because if we optimize something, right, and if it doesn't work, so we just throw it away and try it again. So, you know, and it seems to be a process called de-optimization.
Yes.
And I always wondered why we need a process when we can throw it away. You know what I mean?
Well, it's more sort of highlighting the fact that you are throwing that code away. Okay. And so what you'll see is, if you look at the performance of your application, especially during warm-up, you'll see that the graph will kind of gradually go up as you get more and more code compiled. And then there'll be a dip. Mm-hmm. And that dip is because you have had a de-optimization. A method has had to be thrown away, and that's gone back to either interpreted mode or C1 compiled code. And then you've got to go through the same process of identifying information and then recompiling it with either C2 or Falcon, and then getting better performance that way. So you'll see dips in performance as you warm
up. This is literally throwing away and re-optimizing, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So we just call it the optimization.
Oh, okay.
But yes, so that allows us to generate more heavily optimized code. Mm-hmm. And to give you an example of how well that works, if we take Kafka as an example. So Kafka is a JVM-based messaging system, Apache project. You know, lots of people know it. Lots of people use it. And if we simply change the JVM underneath a Kafka installation, we can actually deliver up to 53% more transactions per second than with Hotspot. And that's because we're generating more heavily optimized code specifically for the Kafka platform, and that allows us to run it faster. So that is just one example. I mean, there's lots of other things that we can compile and test. So things like Cassandra, for example, I think the current benchmark we have on that is about 30% more transactions per second. So although we can't guarantee we'll get 50% for everything, we are talking about increases in performance of like 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%. So it's not 1%, 1.5%. It's a significant increase in performance.
Yeah, even 10% is huge.
Yes.
If you're running in the cloud, you get a huge cost savings. And if you run on your own data center, usually it doesn't matter. But in the cloud, you immediately see a difference, you know, on the bill.
That's right. And that's one of the things that with Falcon now is it much more appealing to people, because even though they may not be performance constrained, as in, you know, their application is performing the way that it needs to, but if we can invert the idea of getting better performance and say, well, you can do more with less, then you can save on your cloud bill, as you rightly point out.
From the architectural perspective, is Falcon part of the garbage collector or of the JVM?
It's part of the JVM.
Very good.
But it's the JIT compiler. So replacement for C2. Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, there's a discussion about performance of garbage collection and and what it actually the result is, faster application, which has nothing to do with garbage collection, even memory savings. So sometimes really confusing because, you know, years ago, if we talk about garbage collector optimization, we tried, you know, to make stop the world shorter. And the recent discussions, if we talk about garbage collection, is more like make the application faster because, you know, the stop the world, I mean, doesn't happen anymore. So this is an interesting part, right?
That's true. But you also have to remember that the garbage collection work still happens. Mm-hmm. So even if you move to a concurrent model where you're not seeing pauses, what you will see is a drop in throughput because you're basically doing the work of the garbage collection all the time whilst the application is running.
Yeah, I don't know whether you remember for sure. I don't know. I know actually. 2008, 9, 10, there was a lot of discussion, real-time JVMs. And this was the entire idea that the garbage collector always runs. On every tick, the garbage collector runs and therefore it is slower but more predictable, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember working on that when I was at Sun, the real-time system for Java. And it had a number of different approaches. So like you said, there was a predictable garbage collector where it would do a certain amount of work each tick, like you said. But the other thing that RTSJ had, which was very different, was it had the concept of immortal memory, where you could allocate memory, but then it would never be garbage collected. And that meant that you had to use a different programming approach, because you had to think to yourself, right, what is the data that I need to keep in my application that's going to be long running? Doesn't need to be garbage collected. So, you know, I've got certain variables or certain data that I need to maintain for the lifetime of the application. And if I have that, then I can put that in immortal memory, not be worried by the garbage collector, and then try and minimize what I'm doing in terms of intermediate object creation as the application runs.
This was almost like a garbage collector less programming, right?
Yes.
So you have to be very efficient and never throw anything away in hope you don't get object out of
Exactly, yes. It becomes a more challenging programming approach, because you do have to think a lot more about what's happening underneath to get that predictability in terms of real time. But I mean, real time is great for certain applications, but most applications don't need hard real time, which is what you're dealing with there. Soft real time, which is where you've got, you know, more predictable but not guaranteed, then most people are quite happy with that.
So I think from the perspective of 2010 efforts to have a real-time garbage collector or real-time JVM, I think Zinc could be called as real-time, right? From with no, considering back then, you know, the requirements from back then and to now, it could be real-time, right?
Yes. I would describe it as soft real-time.
Yeah. Because it's not guaranteed that it won't stop for...
Exactly, yes.
But what can be guaranteed? So if you have Zinc and huge heap, I mean, it won't stop for 1.5 days, I'm pretty sure. So, you know, the maximum it will stop, like 1 minute? What is the known maximum in total in the worst possible case for Zinc, you know, we are aware of?
I would say it's of the order of milliseconds. Yeah, because, like I said, we literally don't have... a stop world, full compacting, fallback position. So what you will see is that the garbage collector will work. And if it can't keep up with the rate of allocation and the size of the heap and so on, you will literally get to an out-of-memory error. So you will either see millisecond pauses or the application will stop.
So why it is called soft real-time then? Because I could say, you know, it is hard real-time below 100 milliseconds or 50 milliseconds, whatever.
Right, because there are too many other aspects of the JVM for it to be considered hard real-time.
Okay.
Hard real-time is where you do have predictability and guarantees. But if you wanted to run a real-time Java virtual machine, you need a real-time operating system underneath it. You can't run a real-time JVM on a standard OS. So if you put it on Linux, it won't be, even a RTSJ won't be hard real time, because you need the guarantees from the operating system underneath.
But if you would migrate Zinc to a real time operating system, it would be real time.
Even then, I don't think we could give that guarantee, because there's still other aspects of the JVM which introduce non-deterministic interrupts in terms of the flow. So there's various other things that happen.
I was so focused on the garbage collector and forgot all the other things. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Got you. I was just, you know, laser focused garbage collection. And from garbage collection perspective, we could say it is real time because we have the guarantees, but there are other aspects of JVM which destroy the idea. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Very cool. Okay, sorry, I interrupted several times, but it was interesting.
No, that's fine. Yeah, so essentially, with Falcon, we can generate better performing code, as I said, with, you know, 10, 20, 30% improvement in performance. And then the other thing that we've done is we looked at that warm-up time, and we said, how can we improve that? And the approach that we took to solving that problem was saying, well, when you start up an application, every time you start it starts up cold, in that it has no memory of any application run before. That means that every time you start the same application, it has to go through the process of identifying which methods, are being used frequently, compiling those with C1, profiling them, recompiling them with C2 or Falcon, going through de-optimizations, getting to that steady state. And it does that every single time. Mm-hmm. What we said is, okay, let's let the application warm up as a training run, and you can use that in production. So you've got fully, the data that you need for a proper run. Run it in production, let it warm up, and then we'll take a profile of the running application. Mm-hmm. And the profile consists of, well, 4 or 5 pieces of data. So you've got a list of all the currently loaded classes. You've got a list of all the currently initialized classes, because that mm-hmm. isn't necessarily the same. You've got all the profiling data that was collected for the JIT compilation that happened until that point. Mm-hmm. And then you have a list of all the methods, and potentially we even keep a copy of the code that has been compiled. Mm-hmm. When you start the application again, rather than starting from scratch, we can feed that in as a memory from the previous run. When we do that, obviously the JVM can say, okay, now I know exactly which classes to load, exactly which classes to initialize straight away. Then I can go through and I can compile all the information, or compile all the methods I need. We also keep a copy of the optimizations that happen, and this is where that's important. Mm-hmm. We can avoid those de-optimizations because we know what failed previously, compile all the code. So when you get to the main entry point in your application, mm-hmm. by the time you get there, all the code is compiled, and literally you'd have about 98% of the performance that you had when you took that profile. Mm-hmm. Can't quite get to 100% because there's a couple of things that the JVM does at startup that means there's certain things we can't do ahead of time, but literally you're about 97-98% of the performance you had. And that means you get a very, very steep warm-up mm-hmm. slope. Of course, the problem is that there's all that work has to be done before you get to main, which means you get a sort of period of time when the application's not doing anything. But that works very well, again, in situations like where you've got a trading system and you know that at 9 o'clock in the morning you're going to start trading. What the traders will do is they'll start their applications at like 10 to 9, go through all the process of compiling everything and getting ready. And then when the bell hits at 9 o'clock, the application's ready to go and off it goes with full speed, ready to handle transactions.
Yeah, it's also nothing unusual because if you're in the cloud, it's the same auto-scaling with load balancers. You also have to mm-hmm. do something, you know, if yes. there's an event, you are preparing for the event. Mm. So it's business as usual, I would say.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And then
you said JVM cannot do everything. So what cannot be done? Why did 2%?
Yeah, that's when you get into some of the technicalities of what mm-hmm. the JVM does at warm up and what the JVM specification says. I must admit, I can't remember the exact details of what it is.
No details, but just roughly, what cannot be done?
It's something to do with the way classes are initialized certain aspects of that. Part of
classes
the
so very early initialization, like classes initialization, and maybe the metadata
yes.
stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then the other thing that we've done related to that idea of warm up time and the issues of JIT compilation is we then said, okay, how about when we're working in a cloud, why don't we disconnect the JIT compiler from the JVM, make mm-hmm. that into a centralized service, so JIT as a service, which is what we call the cloud native compiler. Now, what happens when you start your application, when it needs to compile a method, rather than doing it locally, meaning it has to use the CPU and the memory of the JVM that's actually running, we send it across the network to our centralized cloud native compiler. It will do the compilation there and then pass it back to the JVM. Again, the benefit of that is one, you're not having to do the compilation locally, so you're not competing with resources with your application code. So if you're running in a small like 2 vCore or 1 vCore container, you're not using those resources to do JIT compilation. But the other thing is that cloud native compiler can be a longer running service, which means that, again, it has the memory. When you pass a method across to be compiled, if we've already compiled it for a different instance of the same microservice, for example, then we can just pass that straight back, and that means you get faster results for that compilation.
But what it could do as well is, because you have more data, you could perform more how to call it
more heavy overall optimizations.
Yes.
And that's exactly what we do. So we will do a compilation, and then if we find that the cloud native compiler is quiet for a while, we'll actually devote the resources we've got to doing harder optimizations for the same code. So the next time you ask for that method, we've got a better compiled version that we can hand back to you.
And you could also have do like more predictive optimizations, because to say, okay, your profile is very similar to the other microservices, and I'm pretty sure that in future, if you do this, we could optimize this way, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. And I assume because the cloud native JIT, how do you call it? Cloud native compiler?
Cloud native compiler.
The cloud native compiler knows all the classes. You could even introduce some security aspects. You can say, wait a second, this class is dangerous. What are you doing here? You are not allowed to start at all.
I suppose we could. We haven't done that yet, but I guess that's something that we certainly could look at.
You know, like the log4 shell, for instance?
Yes.
So then you could say, okay, this class in this version is a little bit dangerous. And yeah, cool. And this question doesn't make any sense, but I will ask anyway because it's interesting. But the 1.5 day stop the world use case. I'm assuming what I wanted to ask, what will happen if you would use the Zinc compiler back then, and what will happen? It would just run faster, because we already said that this is why I said it doesn't make any sense, because the millisecond stop the world, either it will garbage collect for milliseconds, or we get out of memory, or we get out of memory error.
Yes.
But I assume what you did back then is you introduced the old version of Zinc then. What was the impact?
So the impact was that we solved their problem. I mean, they were absolutely over the moon that we could eliminate that very, very long pause that they had. Yeah. So it went down, you know, to the order of milliseconds. Of course, there was an impact in terms of throughput. Mm-hmm. So we were able to adjust in terms of the resources, not from the memory point of view, but in terms of the CPU that was allocated to it. By allocating more CPU to it, then we could compensate for the fact that we were doing fully concurrent garbage collection. Mm-hmm. But it did mean that they got around that whole problem of a very, very long pause.
How well C4 scales? Let's say I have 2 CPUs versus 10 CPUs.
2 CPUs would be fine. We actually, the minimum configuration that we specify for C4 is obviously like 1 vCore with 512 megabytes of memory. Mm-hmm. But to be realistic, you really want a gigabyte of memory to run it effectively. You can get away with it in 512 megs, but I don't think it's not really designed for that kind of profile.
So Apple Watch, something like this.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to ask, if I get 10 CPUs, will your garbage collector use all these 10 cores?
No. So the way that's configurable, it's one of those ones that sort of
can.
Like, yes, it could do if you really wanted to.
Yeah, I wanted. So this is what I'm asking, because some modern applications don't use my hardware, you know? The question is, could I, if I have, you know, a hell of a machine, could I configure the Zinc that way that it use everything it finds?
Oh, yes. And in fact, that's one of the great things about the way the algorithm works, is because if you look at the approach, it's not just concurrent, it's also parallel. Mm-hmm. And that by that I mean that we can allocate multiple threads to the garbage collector and have that work very efficiently, because there's three phases to C4. The first phase is the marking phase, which is where we identify all the objects which are currently in use. And that is where you create a root set. It's a fairly standard thing with garbage collectors, where you basically find all the directly accessible objects from your heap, and not from your heap, but from your stack and your registers and so on. And then you have to follow the links from those objects to any objects that they reference and do that to build up a complete graph of the accessible objects. But the thing about having a root set is you've got like lots of objects in that root set. You can apply multiple threads to that, because there's no issue of bumping into each other, because one thread can work on one object and, you know, follow the graph of that. Another thread can work on a different object or set of objects and follow the graph of those. So it's very efficient in terms of parallelization.
Mm-hmm. And but the threads could run on multiple cores, nothing, right?
Oh yes, yeah, absolutely, yes.
And I think virtual threads don't matter, right? Because you are very low level. You are below the virtual threads.
Yes, because virtual threads is at the application level.
Yeah,
and what's happening is the individual Java threads in your application. What's happening is rather than each Java thread mapping to a platform thread, mm-hmm. the operating system thread, you've got a number of Java threads which are being mm-hmm. mapped to one platform thread. But mm-hmm. the JVM is using multiple platform threads mm-hmm. to do the work of the garbage collector.
Because in theory, it could be, because there's a work like you're aware of Espresso, right? This is like the GraalVM pure JVM. And if you will implement the JVM in Java, then you, in theory, could use virtual threads, you know?
Well, yes. I don't think anybody's actually tried that. Because essentially all that virtual threads are doing is providing a continuation and then letting the JVM act as the scheduler for
those. You have multiple waiting things, and you have a pool link, right? It's like a thread.
It is, yeah. And the problem with virtual threads in that particular context is that because virtual threads are not governed by like time sharing, so there isn't the idea of preemption of mm-hmm. virtual threads. Mm-hmm. Virtual threads work great if you've got an application which is I/O bound,
exactly.
because you
mm-hmm.
want your threads to pause whilst they're doing I/O, because that mm-hmm. allows the JVM then to switch that thread over to doing something else. Mm-hmm. But if your thread doesn't do any I/O, it won't be preempted, and so you will hold on to that thread as long as you're doing work on it. So that wouldn't then work very well if you were trying to write a JVM using non-preemptive threads.
But maybe in the context of a CPU, memory access could be I/O.
If it blocks, yes.
Yes, this could be considered as I/O, right?
Yeah, as long as it blocks, that's okay. I'm trying to think this through.
So we get Zing 2.0, or you get bankrupt. This is more likely, actually. So I'm assuming Zing is implemented in C or lower level, and this is
C++.
C++, this virtual threads doesn't make any sense because they are below the JVM, but it was an interesting idea. I just
got it. Yes.
Very good. So what it means is C4, what it does is C1 is the same as it was before. There was mm-hmm. nothing to optimize. It's already great. And what's the C1? I forgot. It was the interpreter in your language, right?
No, so C1 is where you compile the code very quickly, but you don't apply optimizations based on profiling.
So, native compilation. We're talking about... Yeah. So it was like... Yeah, without optimization means one-to-one, or this is like very primitive compilation, just go without any heuristics.
I mean, it does some optimizations in terms of where it can do static analysis, like dead code elimination, a bit of loop unrolling, things like that, possibly. But it's not able to do any of the speculative optimizations because it doesn't have any profile data.
Do you do any? Actually, this is interesting. So are you actually using C1 in your Zinc?
Yeah. Because, I mean, it still makes sense because you need to get an improvement in speed initially mm-hmm. and then allow you to do the profiling that will then feed into the secondary JIT compiler.
But if you have already profile, then you don't use C1 anymore, right? Then you can plug the...
Yeah, so if you combine... if you use ReadyNow, because ReadyNow mm-hmm. has all the profiling data in it, then yes, we skip the C1 way of doing things and we just go straight to Falcon mm-hmm.
and
compile.
C2 as well?
We used to have C2 in the JVM as well as Falcon, but we've since dropped that. So we only have Falcon now.
Okay. So it makes sense. So C1 is the primitive optimization. C2... Is what was C2 originally? This was the hotspot, but you said it was monolithic.
It used to be that C1 was the what was called the client compiler, and C2 used to be called the server compiler. So that's where
now I know. Okay, this is, and back then in JVM there were even two arguments, minus server and minus client.
Exactly. Yes, and then they introduced the idea of what was called tiered compilation. Mm-hmm. So it was where effectively you change gear. So mm-hmm. you start off in interpretive mode. You use C1 compile code mm-hmm. So client JIT compiler, and then you switch to the server JIT compiler.
Uh-huh. And I use the client a lot for Swing and JavaFX, and the server one for servers. So this was the trick back then. Okay, so C1 still makes sense. So right now, we could actually also use C1 for CLI applications, scripts, stuff like that. Still makes sense, right? So one shot.
It does, yes. Because if you've got very short-lived applications, mm-hmm. then, yeah, they're probably not going to get into C2 or Falcon because they're just, you know, compiling code very quickly.
Oh, yeah. But the client, minus client, doesn't make it is, you can say, like... not interpreted mode, there's another setting. I can say, don't optimize anything. I use it in serverless. Forgot right now the flag. And because for Lambda, it's the same. If it runs for 1 minute, who cares, right? And okay, so C1, C2. And what you can do is you remember what you optimized and you can store it locally, or you can store it in a cloud.
Yes.
And then perform more aggressive optimizations. And because you have more data, better optimizations. And if you start a new service, the service is ready to go because it gets 98% of the optimizations, right?
Exactly. So we have a thing called Optimizer Hub, mm-hmm. which is exactly what you just said, where you can either store the profile for your application locally. So if you're creating a container image, for example, you can put the files for the profile into the container image and have them accessed locally, or you can use the Optimizer Hub, which is where you store them centrally. When you create your container image, you set up the startup script, so it says here's where to get the profile from. What that allows you to do is obviously change the profile independently from your container. So if you want to have a different profile that you provide, you don't have to rebuild your container. You can just say, okay, change the image or change the thing that's on the Optimizer Hub, and then that will be downloaded the next time it runs.
Mm-hmm. And this downloading happens by Zinc. So this is like...
Yep.
Okay. That's actually quite interesting. So what we only discuss one product, right? Inventory and something like this is not even there. It's just one product. How much could you were able to reuse from the old Vega hardware? You know, because it seems like mm-hmm. it was also similar. It was distributed. There was a JVM stub run on the Vega, on Sun, and it was other way around on the Sun machines, and it was actually executed on the Vega machine. Was there some, you know, some shared code on best practices or something like this?
I'd have to say that was before my time at Azul, and I have no idea about that. But I suspect very little, if any.
Okay. Because I had a chat with Gil, Gil, and it sounds similar. I mean, it's also distributed, but it was other way around. You know, you could install the JVM on the Sun stations, and it was executed on the central host, which was like virtualization on steroids back then, mm-hmm. which was crazy. You have to look at this; you will love it. I think.
Yes.
Gil has still one machine in his garage.
Yeah.
Okay. So we C4. Are we done with C4?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
So so what we discussed was Zinc. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned RedNow. Is Zinc and RedNow one product or two?
One product. So you get everything in a single product. So if you want to buy our what we call Prime, which is the Zinc JVM, comes with RedNow, comes with the Optimizer Hub, comes with the Cloud Native Compiler that you can set up. So a Cloud Native Compiler is just a Kubernetes pod that you can deploy into the cloud, or you can deploy it on your own hardware. It's just, mm-hmm. set it up and then point your JVM at where that is. It's all one product.
Okay. So I think we are done because there is no time left for other products, like Inventory, for instance, really interesting one. And where people can find you, Zinc, Prime, RedNow, and the Cloud Native Compiler, where to find everything.
Yep. So have a look at azul.com. Very easy.
Azul.com.
So, yeah. Nice short web address. But everything is on there. So there's lots of details about what we do and more information about that. And if anybody's interested in trying this, then we're very happy to let people try it out before they, you know, buy, because there's no guarantee on how much of a performance improvement you get. So it's the idea that you run a pilot, test it with your application, compare running your application using Hotspot, run the same application, same workload, same machine, everything, just switch to Zinc and see what the difference in performance is.
But having heard that, so if you're running something not on Prime and there's a long-running process in the cloud, let's say EC2 or Kubernetes, it will pay off.
Yes. Yeah.
Because 10%, at least 10% faster.
Let me temper your enthusiasm a little bit there. I can't guarantee even 10%. I mean, we see some applications, I'm going to be completely open about this. We do see some applications where performance is worse. Mm-hmm. Now, if we do see an application where performance is worse, we obviously treat that as effectively a bug, and we will then basically analyze that to find out mm-hmm. why the code that's being generated mm-hmm. by our JIT compiler mm-hmm. leads to worse performance than Hotspot. Mm-hmm. But depending on what the application does, will have a very big impact on the level of performance improvement mm-hmm. you get.
Mm-hmm. What I meant is transactional application where there's lots of transactions in my world, so it probably will run faster. And of course, there's applications which are not typical one. If one mm-hmm. sits, in sense, I don't know, messages to the mm-hmm. browser every 10 seconds, maybe not, because, there is nothing to save, right? So this is exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then, and your name is Simon Ritter, so that you is, are also, yes. Speak Java, right?
That's
speak
right, yes.
Speak Java on Twitter, exactly. So thank you a lot, and see you next time.
Thank you very much.